and to you. We saw, actually, in the film, that Kynan Dutton, one of Cobb's supporters in the film, he says that white children under the age of 5 are now the minority in the US for the first time, and he's concerned about this. And do you think that they go to leave as a sort of sense of sanctuary, that they're under attack and they're being victimized?
Yeah, I don't think that statistic is true. In fact, I'm sure it's not. But yeah, they're going there thinking, oh, we're under attack. You know, us white people are, you know, we're the persecuted. That's never been true, obviously, and it's not been true in history. And I don't know why they feel like they're under attack. I think, I don't know.
Do you think it would have been good to explore that a bit more?
You listen to them talk, and you think, it's very rare that I hear someone talk and I can't put my mind, you know, I can't see the situation through their eyes. And this guy, Kynan, was, and his wife is in the film as well. They talk, they're quite reasonable, they're quite articulate, but I can't identify with anything they say. I can't sit there and say, oh, I see your point, because their point is just, it's just warped, it's wrong, and I don't know if obviously they're just living in their circle of friends, and they have news that they're believing, and they're not really paying attention to what's actually happening in the world.
Mm. It raises many questions, yes, and we get little glimpses into their lives.
And I think it's interesting in the film that, you know, it basically is a First Amendment issue, and America is unusual that hate speech is not illegal in America. It's protected. So people can say the most horrifying things. They can fly their swastikas, which you can't do in Europe. You can't say those things in Europe. But you can say them there, and it's a different legal situation. So that's why you watch it, and it's for a European especially, it's really horrifying to see, because you couldn't do that in Europe.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there on that note, and please do watch this documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you, and don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Frigid temperatures grip parts of the United States that are unaccustomed to a deep freeze as officials demanded an investigation into widespread power outages. At least 23 people died in the storm or its aftermath. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Michael Levinson, Derek Bryson Taylor, David Montgomery, and Campbell Robertson. The piece is titled, Millions Without Power from Spalling Winter Storm. Stay with us for more. Frigid temperatures grip parts of the United States that are unaccustomed to a deep freeze as officials demanded an investigation into widespread power outages. At least 23 people died in the storm or its aftermath. Millions of people remained without power on Tuesday, 16th of February, and were anticipating another cold, dark night in the wake of a deadly winter storm that bulldozed its way across the southern and central parts of the United States this week. In places where such perilously frigid conditions tend to arrive just once in a generation. By late afternoon on Tuesday, 16th of February 2021, the storm was moving into eastern Canada, but the damage left behind was severe. Temperatures across the middle of the country had plummeted to lows not felt in a century or even more, with measurements of minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit in Oklahoma City and minus 20 in Fayetteville, Arkansas, even as a new winter storm was building in the southern plains. At least 23 people have died since winter weather began wreaking havoc last week, some from the cold itself and some from attempts to escape it. And almost 4 million customers across the country remained without electricity on Tuesday evening, 16th of February, according to PowerOutage.us, which aggregates live power data from utilities. More than 3.5 million of those outages were in Texas, where many people had been without power for hours or even days in freezing temperatures. Texas leaders, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, expressed sharp criticism of the operation of the state's power grid, and the Texas House Speaker announced a legislative hearing looking into the widespread power outages. The disruptions caused problems at water treatment plants, leading to boil water advisories for hundreds of thousands of people across Texas, from Fort Worth down to Rio Grande Valley. Some customers lost water altogether, forced to flush their toilets with melting snow. By early Tuesday afternoon, Southwest Power Pool, which manages the electrical grid across 17 central and western states, had stopped ordering controlled rolling cutoffs of power service to customers as the energy supply began meeting the extreme demand, a spokesman said. The storm also severely disrupted the distribution of the coronavirus vaccine, forcing vaccination sites to close down across southern United States and hampering the shipments of vaccine doses. The brutal cold in the middle of the country seemed to defy a trend of ever milder winters, but the frigid temperatures in Texas could be a consequence of global warming. There is research suggesting that the Arctic warming is weakening the jet stream, the high-level air current that circles the northern latitudes and usually holds back the frigid polar vortex. The death toll related to the storm that swept across the southern and central United States this week, accompanied by record-breaking cold temperatures, continued to rise on Tuesday, 16th of February 2021. In Houston, Texas, a woman and a girl died from carbon monoxide poisoning after a car was left running in a garage to generate heat, according to Houston police. A homeless man was also found dead at an overpass. And a man who was found dead on a median in Midtown Houston on Monday was suspected to have died from the extreme cold, the Harris County Sheriff said. A grandmother and three children were killed in a house fire in Sugar Land, Texas, early on Tuesday, 16th of February, in a neighborhood that was without power, according to local news outlets. In southern Louisiana, a man died after slipping on ice and hitting his head, officials said. And a 10-year-old boy died in Tennessee after falling into an icy pond. The authorities in San Antonio, Texas, said that weather conditions contributed to the death of a 78-year-old man. Slippery roads were responsible for 10 deaths in Kentucky and Texas, including a pileup in Fort Worth that involved more than 100 vehicles and killed 6 people. In Missouri, a 59-year-old man was killed when a snowplow collided with his pickup truck on Monday afternoon, 15th of February. A person who got out of a vehicle after a car crash in Houston, Texas, late on Monday, was struck and killed. The weather-driven destruction this week did not come solely from ice and snow. In coastal North Carolina, a tornado killed 3 people and injured at least 10 others early on Tuesday morning, 16th of February, though it was unclear if it was meteorologically related to the winter storm. 2 Houston emergency rooms treated about 100 cases of carbon monoxide poisoning over a 16-hour period from Monday to Tuesday, 15th and 16th of February. A huge spike, a hospital spokeswoman said, as residents of the city shivering without power resorted to dangerous methods of keeping themselves warm. Doctors said they were concerned about running out of treatment options if the rush of patients with carbon monoxide poisoning continued. People with severe cases of carbon monoxide poisoning must be placed into a hyperbaric chamber to receive oxygen. The Houston emergency rooms only have a handful available. It's definitely very alarming, said Dr. Salil Bandari, an emergency medicine physician affiliated with the Memorial Hermann Hospital at the Texas Medical Center. Dr. Bandari and medical staff treated 57 patients late on Monday and early on Tuesday, half of them children, he said. 25 of those patients needed to spend time in the hyperbaric chamber, Dr. Bandari said, and he can only treat 6 people at a time. The hospital typically treats about 75 to 100 cases of carbon monoxide poisoning during an entire year, according to a hospital spokeswoman. Meanwhile, as millions of Texans endured their second day of power blackouts caused by a devastating winter storm, Texas Governor Greg Abbott called for an emergency reform of the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, known as ERCOT, saying the operator of the state's power grid has been anything but reliable over the past 48 hours. Greg Abbott designated his call for an investigation and reform of ERCOT as an emergency item in the current Texas legislative session, putting it on a fast track towards enactment. The announcement came just after the Texas House Speaker, Dade Phelan, ordered a 25th of February Joint Committee hearing to investigate ERCOT and determine what caused the lights to go off across the Lone Star State. Both the governor and the House Speaker said their goal is to ensure that the conditions never reoccur. The sharply worded response from two of the state's top political leaders came amid a fierce public backlash after millions of Texans were left without power following a storm packing record snow and single-digit temperatures late on Sunday and Monday, 14th and 15th of February. Far too many Texans are without power and heat for their homes as our state faces freezing temperatures and severe winter weather, the governor said. And this is unacceptable. As the operator of the state's power grid, ERCOT has faced high demands for electricity throughout the storm and imposed blackouts to distribute the power burden across the overloaded system. Hundreds of thousands of Texans have gone without power and electricity for hours at a time, and in many cases well over a day. Bill Magness, ERCOT's president and chief executive, said in an interview on Austin's KXAN TV on Tuesday that the council was trying to get people's power back on as quickly as possible, but at the same time needed to safely manage the balance of supply and demand on the grid to avoid larger collapses in the power system. As hard as these power outages are, he said, they avoid a much more catastrophic situation. At the national level, though, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the North American Electric Reliability Corporation said on Tuesday they would jointly investigate the blackouts and electric grid failures in Midwestern and Southern United States.
Debate.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement has warned Israel that any act of aggression against Lebanon could lead to an all-out war. Said Hassan Nasrallah said that Hezbollah does not seek a military confrontation, but if it's pushed into one, it will display a resistance stronger than ever before. In this edition of Debate, we will look at the possibilities of a war between Israel and Lebanon and whether Israel is adequately prepared for one.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah's Secretary General warned Israel that any act of aggression on the Gaza Strip or Lebanon could turn into an all-out war.
In any future confrontation, the home front of the occupation entity will face actualities it has never faced since the establishment of its entity. The time of threats and fear is over. The Resistance Alliance is following up all developments with calm and precision.
Nasrallah reiterated that the Israelis, especially Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, will continue to magnify normalization deals with some Arab states and use the issue for political and electoral gains. Hezbollah's leader, however, stressed that the people of the region will continue to boycott Israel.
Even in those Arab states that are normalizing ties, we bargain on the people. This is the struggle of the people. I'm telling them they do not need to take on arms or shed blood. All you need to do is boycott, which means do not normalize ties. Do not accept Israeli products or meet with Israelis or visit Israelis or welcome Israelis.
Experts believe the resistance has had exceptional achievements in its struggle against the Israeli regime.
The resistance has achieved two victories unprecedented in Arab and Muslim history and has achieved two liberations. Had it not been for the resistance, there would have not been a Lebanon. We need to remember that in 2000 and in 2006, there was no Arab side with the resistance. On the contrary, they conspired against it. There are many challenges facing it. There will be more people against it, and the Israelis will try to continue with their efforts to normalize ties with more Arab regimes while the resistance has become a united regional power.
Nasrallah was speaking on the anniversary of the martyrdom of Hezbollah's former Secretary General, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, scholar Sheikh Raghab Harb, and military commander Imad Mughni. The martyrdom of these leaders, although at different intervals in the history of the resistance, represents the continued path toward liberation. After some 40 years of resistance and struggle against Israeli occupation and Takfiri terrorism, Hezbollah has lost many commanders, three of whom are commemorated in February of every year. And despite gaining strength and the many victories, Hezbollah's resistance is constantly in a state of defending Lebanon and advocating the need to remain apprehensive of U.S., Israeli, and Takfiri threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Joining us in this debate, activist and political analyst Leith Madarouf joins us from Beirut. We have journalist and political analyst Julia Kassem, who also joins us from Beirut. I'd like to welcome you both. Leith Madarouf, let me first start with you. The Israeli forces holding these large-scale exercises along the northern border with Lebanon. Why did Israel perform these exercises to warrant a warning from Hezbollah?
Well, basically, they have been conducting exercises for the past year and a half, almost. Every couple of months, we see apartheid Israel doing exercises in the Golan Heights, in the northern Galilee of occupied Palestine. And it is all partially because of they are projecting psychological warfare on the peoples of Syria and Lebanon, but also because apartheid Israel itself knows that its armed forces, its land forces specifically, are not ready for any war, an actual invasion of any country. And if there's a confrontation on the borders with Lebanon, their army, the land forces, are going to be defeated resoundingly very fast. And so apartheid Israel is very worried on its future, what will happen in a confrontation with a force like Hezbollah that is professional and dedicated to its just cause. We know without the land force, there couldn't be any victory for apartheid Israel.
Okay, well, Julia Kassem, just to expand a little bit more on this, we've seen also the air maneuvers take place by Israeli forces. They called it the Rose of the Galilee, involved dozens of jets, and we also know that there was a scenario where the Lebanese Hezbollah group fired a missile at an IF. This is a scenario now. It landed the shot but failed to bring down the aircraft. It almost sounds like Israel, or looks like Israel, is trying to provoke Hezbollah, either in terms of a mindset that, hey, we're preparing for a war, or that this is what our capabilities are, in which then you have the warning coming from Hezbollah. How do you see the way that Israel has displayed itself and, in turn, the warning coming from Hezbollah?
Israel has known for full well now that any provocation that leads to war or any war between itself and the resistance is going to be a losing battle, not militarily in an isolated context, but an existential loss for the occupying entity. It is well aware of Hezbollah's military capabilities that have exceeded Israel's ability to really, fight them and win. Israel knows that it's going to lose in battle, so it knows it will absolutely be decimated. So for the past at least a couple of years now, you've seen a lot of psychological provocations by Israel. If you remember, in mid to late 2019, a lot of the provocations at the border by Israel, which coincided with strikes along the Iraq-Syria border and whatnot. This last Christmas, the day after Christmas, we did have a low-flying jet, Israeli aircraft, as just another maneuver of psychological terror. And it's no surprise right now that we have nearly daily violations of airspace over Lebanon. Israeli drones coming in and out daily, and a lot of these go and end up striking Syria as well. So when this provocation is, a part of it is definitely a flexing of muscles to kind of show, to try to posture that there is capabilities, even though Israel well knows that there isn't capability sufficient to defeat the resistance. And an incitation that wants to, fight, basically posture psychologically without having to really, while keeping, saving face, kind of in the midst of electoral and political disarray in Israel, complete lack of soldier morale. You have soldiers just refusing to fight. Israeli army is weaker than ever. So they're basically trying to prove in front psychologically and in airspace what they clearly can't deliver on the ground.
Okay, so since we're talking about the Israeli, well, it's funny that we were talking about the Israeli military, once regarded to be one of the most powerful militaries in the world, but at this point it has now been degraded to, well, let me not say it myself. I'm going to use the top general back in 2018 of Israel, who said Israel not ready for war, in which he said Israeli military has invested most of its resources in the Air Force while neglecting the Land Corps, leaving Israel vulnerable to Hezbollah. How did Israel get to this point, Leif Meruv?
It got to this point with the democratization of military technologies that happened in the last decade. So beyond the fact that Hezbollah's tactics have surpassed those of Israel in their ability to expel the occupation from Lebanon in 2000, in its tactics to defeat the invasion of 2006 and withstand the bombardment from the air. But now, added to all of that, we have a democratization of military technology that happened in the last two decades. So we see smaller actors able to build drones that can go to very far locations and pinpoint hits, as well as cruise missiles being proliferated within the smaller actors. So we have now a situation where a country with the most advanced air power and the most advanced surveillance technologies in the world is not able to defeat smaller players like Yemen and Hezbollah and Syria in their battles. So this is a grave danger for apartheid Israel and for the imperialist camp, and they know that, and they can see it in fact through tested battles of now the years that we saw in Yemen and the withstanding of the people there. So Hezbollah definitely is ready. Apartheid Israel knows it. The United States knows it. And all they can do is just bark as loud as they can, thinking that that's going to make them look like that they are strong.
Yeah, well, barking is one thing, but Julia Qassem, they are actually carrying out military operations inside Syria. They have bombed Syria on a number of occasions. The reasoning twofold. One, Iranian positions, in which Iran has said were there at the invitation of the Syrian government in the role of advisories, and also Hezbollah fighters who are in Syria. And let's not forget that initially the presence of Hezbollah fighters along with Iranian advisory roles were to defeat the Daesh terrorists. What's your view on the way that Israel is targeting Hezbollah fighters in Syria?
Yeah, you know, Israel is an expanding U.S. military base, essentially. And the defeats successively in 2000, the liberation of Lebanon 2000, with the inability for Israel to really, you know, beat Hezbollah, and in fact, actually strengthen the resistance's capabilities. And again, after the Syrian war, when Syria became the target as a supporter and ally of the resistance, its failure there has basically posed an existential threat to its expansionism, its role as, like, its propagation of being the strongest military in the world. You know, Syria now is a prime target, partially for its, you know, ever-present expansionist tendencies, but also for the ground forces present at the invitation from the Syrian government of Hezbollah and of Iran as well, that Israel wants to target. It wants to take down Syria as one of the supporters and allies, but it also wants to take down Iran and Hezbollah in Syria as the backbone of what has assisted and sustained Syria from falling to ruin, and in turn, also the resistances in Lebanon, in Palestine, and in elsewhere, in Iraq as well, that work hand in hand together to basically kind of for all thoughts of occupation. And we see that the Damascus has been that target for those exact reasons.
Well, we're looking at a new U.S. administration here, Leith Maruf. We know that Trump, obviously a staunch supporter of Israel, had very much the backing of the U.S. when it came to anything that Israel pretty much said. But things, I think, may be changing now with this new U.S. administration, because we're seeing in the news, for example, how the U.S., through Biden, is going to reset its relationship with Israel. Does Israel have any backing when it comes to its thoughts on military engagements with Hezbollah or Lebanon in general, even though you have, for example, the French president who come and said Hezbollah is part of the government there, it's part of the political institution there, you know, and it's got to be included. So you don't have Israel exactly having the backing of the so-called international community, which in essence really comes down to the U.S. in its case.
Well, really, it's just an exchange of roles between France and the United States and some other European countries. They play this game of the good cop, bad cop, but ultimately they're there to maintain apartheid Israel and the hegemony of the West over Western Asia and North Africa through the existence of this beachhead military colony that we call Israel. So that's one thing. The other thing that we need to notice is that what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech yesterday in regards to the change in priorities for the Biden regime. You know, there is no real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of what their strategic goals are, which is maintaining American hegemony and power over the region here, but they have differed on tactics and or priorities. So we may see, you know, Russia and China taking more of the brunt of American attention with the Biden regime, than you know, the Middle East, Western Asia, North Africa. So of course, the regional viceroys and vessels of the United States, mainly Saudi Arabia and apartheid Israel, they're going to get less support and attention because the United States wants to butt heads with the big two, China and Russia. And this is very important for the resistance and all people that in the region here to understand that, yes, although the United States is turning its attention towards China and Russia, if there is a battle here on the ground, the United States will be back in a jiffy.
Well, what are we looking at then in the future, for the future, Julia Qassam, when it comes to these two? Israel obviously has done its best. Of course, it's been defeated, the most prominent defeat being the 2006 war. We could talk about other instances, but at this point, given the passage of time, we know how more advanced, as our guest there, Leith Maruf, indicated also, that Hezbollah has gotten militarily. And it shows, especially with some recent downing of Israeli drones, for example, that Hezbollah is adequately prepared, not to mention the tens or hundreds of thousands of rockets that it may have, and pretty much everybody knows where they are pointed at. What future do you see between the two?
So the capability is there, but the strategy with Hezbollah, with Iran, often obviously precedes, you know, the capability. It's not there to flex its muscles like Israel is, which in the latter is the sign of defeat and of weakness. It is still operating on the defensive in the sense that there is a lot of priorities to basically keep the country stable with the midst of economic warfare against the world's hegemons, kind of working against it. So while the capability is there, Hezbollah knows that it has to basically play its cards right and not to really allow Israel to bait it into a war. As we see, like, Israel always wants to provoke, spread propaganda, accusing Hezbollah, as also was mentioned in Sayyid Nasrallah's speech, of, you know, having either assassinated one of the U.S.'s propaganda assets, Luckman Steam, or having stored weapons deposits in the port, which obviously we know is a complete lie. But basically, the propagation is to this propaganda that Israel pushes and the U.S. and its agents in Lebanon like to parrot, aimed at essentially disarming Hezbollah, which is definitely also a sign that Israel knows that it can't compete or face off militarily. In the future, right now, I mean, we're seeing Israel going into further crushing defeat, further crumbling, even without any direct warfare. So I think that its attempts at psychological warfare are countered effectively already as it is. And so, I mean, we know that if in the effect that there's a disastrous war, it'll lose, and it looks like it's headed down that way either way.
Okay, I do have to ask your reaction, Leithmer. This is something that maybe is not highlighted as much, and is one of the things that Netanyahu said when that horrible explosion happened in Lebanon, in which hours before that explosion, the prime minister was at an Israeli military camp, and he issued a warning. It was an ominous warning. It said, quote, "We hit a cell, and now we hit the dispatchers. I suggest to all of them, including Hezbollah, to consider this." An official tour of a military facility in central Israel where Netanyahu said that. What do you think about that statement that Netanyahu made?
Well, you know, most probably apartheid Israel was somehow behind the explosion, but we don't have any of the investigations that have been announced, so I'm going to keep my, sure position on this until we do. But yesterday, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in his speech, referred to the fact that the multiple security apparatuses of Lebanon had conducted fully their investigations, that they have issued reports, and that they were handed over to the public prosecutor office, and that they need to be released because there are people still waiting to collect their money from the insurance companies that are refusing to pay, and so forth. And so, yes, we are living a multilateral war. And one thing that Sayyid Nasrallah referred to also in his speech yesterday was warning apartheid Israel that if they think they can conduct a few days of war and confrontation instead of a full-time war, full-scale war, they are not able to, and they have no power to decide that. But once the war starts, it's not going to be them ending it. And he reasserted the formula that if apartheid Israel decides to attack villages in Lebanon, that the response will be bombing colonies in apartheid Israel. That if they attack cities in Lebanon, the response will be attacking cities in apartheid Israel. So we, you know, yesterday in his speech, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah covered a lot of issues, and one of them is this warning to apartheid Israel not to play with fire.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much for that, activist and political analyst Leith Maruf. Thank you very much, journalist and political analyst Julia Kassem. Pleasure to have you both from Beirut. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mika Vitale, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In recent years, Tunisia has experienced significant economic problems. The country's economy shrank almost 9% in 2020, the largest contraction since its independence in 1953. The official rate of unemployment in Tunisia is 16%. Unemployment in the age group of 15 to 25 is over 36%. The International Monetary Fund, IMF's extended fund facility, imposed several austerity measures, causing the depreciation of the Tunisian dinar in 2017. And consequent inflation has impoverished the popular classes and sharply increased unemployment levels. We now present you an article written by Yanis Iqbal, an independent researcher and freelance writer based in Aligarh, India. The piece is titled "The Revolution Continues in Tunisia." Please stay with us for more of Yanis Iqbal's article. Protests have been occurring in Tunisia since mid-January 2021. On 26th of January 2021, hundreds of Tunisians had marched from the Ethazmen in Tunis to the parliament building in Bardo, calling for the overthrow of the system and development, jobs, freedom and dignity. As the crowd swelled, the protests became one of the largest this year. The police used barricades, water cannons and violence to stop them from reaching the parliament building. The march to the Tunisian parliament was called after the death of a protester in Spetla a day before. The protester, identified as Haykal al-Rashdi, was injured by a tear gas canister fired by police officers during an earlier demonstration. The call for the protest was given by several parties, including the Workers' Party, the Democratic Current, At-Tayyar, the United Democratic Patriotic Party, and the Al-Shaab movement. According to recent estimates by Lawyers Without Frontiers Association, since the beginning of the nightly clashes, more than 1,600 people have been arrested in Tunisia, including activists. Around 600 of those are minors and children. About 23,000 people in Tunisia are currently in jail. These numbers have not decreased over the years. The first round of protests on 14th of January 2021 coincided with the 10th anniversary of the fall of President Ben Ali's regime. Ben Ali's removal from power was the outcome of an intense struggle courageously waged by the Tunisian masses. On 17th of December 2010, Mohamed Bouazizi, a Tunisian street vendor, set himself on fire following yet another instance of harassment and humiliation at the hands of local police and municipal officials. Within hours of Bouazizi's self-immolation, protests began erupting across the town, rapidly gathering pace and spreading towards other urban centers in Tunisia. Mohamed Bouazizi's death was long and agonizing. When he finally died on 4th of January 2011, the conflagration sparked by his act roared into the national capital, Tunis. In a matter of days, President Ben Ali was forced into exile. The Tunisian people did not only oppose the political authoritarianism of the Ben Ali administration, but also the neoliberal policies under his rule, which created massive inequality, unemployment, and widespread misery in the country. The ruling class has completely ignored the latter dimension, choosing to impose further neoliberalism in the aftermath of the Tunisian revolution. Results have been the same: sustained agitations. In 2015, the protests of the unemployed went from the western Kasserine province to the main avenues of Tunis, the capital, the mining area of Gafsa and Sidi Bouzid, the town that started the Islamic Awakening movement. What we're seeing today is the people's desire to complete the revolution that they started back in 2010. In recent years, Tunisia has experienced significant economic problems. The country's economy shrank almost 9% in 2020, the the largest contraction since its independence in 1953. The official rate of unemployment in Tunisia is 16%. However, the majority of those employed are in seasonal or temporary jobs. Unemployment in the age group of 15 to 25 is over 36%. The International Monetary Fund, IMF's extended fund facility, imposed several austerity measures, causing the depreciation of the Tunisian dinar in 2017. And consequent inflation has impoverished the popular classes and sharply increased unemployment levels. The lack of income and employment opportunities has led to the largest exodus of Tunisians from the country in recent years. Tunisians made up the largest number of irregular migrants, over 12,000 in fact, who arrived in Italy in 2020 on boats crossing the Mediterranean Sea, five times more than the previous year. Tunisian migrants risk their lives crossing the Mediterranean Sea, and if they survive that, they face the European Union's brutal border regime and racist discrimination in European countries. Tunisia has a deficit estimated at 11.5% of gross domestic product or GDP in 2020 and public debt at 90% of gross domestic product or GDP. Consequently, the country will issue debt worth up to $3 billion in 2021. Of this, $3 billion, $2.3 billion is expected to come from the International Monetary Fund or IMF. This loan package has its own program of reforms, consisting of cuts to high public wage bill, reduction of subsidies, and privatization of some state-owned companies. In sum, the International Monetary Fund will push for unabated austerity, even as protesters decry the insensitive language of deficit control. What the International Monetary Fund is doing is not new. It was involved in two loan agreements in 2013 and 2016, whose conditionality imposed wage freezes, tax increases, and spending cuts in Tunisia. On average, governments in Tunisia have not lasted for more than a year since 2011, and three have succeeded each other in quick succession in 2020 alone. Political instability has been the norm from the very start of the Tunisian revolution. Following Ben Ali's departure for Saudi Arabia in the winter of 2011, and the interlude that followed, it was Ennahda that would become the leading party within the first two coalition governments voted in by Tunisia's electorate. The first of these governments was led by Hamadi Jebeli, lasting from December of 2011 to March of 2013. On 19th of February 2013, Jebeli resigned following the growing discontent of the workers and youth against austerity measures, the rising cost of living, regional inequalities, growing unemployment, taxes, and escalating political violence. The second government was directed by Ali Larayev and held power from March 2013 until January of 2014. The latter's mandate collapsed when the combination of persistent social turmoil and the assassination of two prominent leftist politicians forced the resignation of his government. The Larayev government agreed to hand over power to a caretaker government of technocrats led by Mahdi Juma in early 2014. A new constitution was introduced on 26th of January 2014, which eliminated the references to Islamic law whilst recognizing Islam as the religion of Tunisia. The constitution-making process occurred against a hypocritical background. The interim government, under the direction of the International Monetary Fund, kept increasing household electricity and gas prices, as well as fuel prices and taxes that would affect taxi drivers and farmers. inspired by the neoliberal orientation embraced by the political forces, the Tunisian people have got disillusioned with the post-2011 political arena, trying to find alternative viewpoints. In 2013, public opinion data revealed the following. 74.5% of the Tunisian people expressed little or no confidence in the government. 89.6% expressed little or no confidence in political parties. And 83.4% expressed little or no confidence in the Tunisian parliament. Some 44.1% of the Tunisian people strongly agreed that the government should take more responsibility to ensure that everyone is provided for. A significant majority backed that same position, and only 3.5% of respondents aligned themselves with a position that people should take more responsibility to provide for themselves. Some 90% of Tunisians strongly agreed that government should constitutionally guarantee social protection and healthcare services to the poor. As much as 30% of Tunisians agreed that taxing the rich to subsidize the poor constitutes an essential characteristic of democracy, with an additional 36.5% skewed towards the agree poll and only 9.9% expressing strong disagreement. About 40.2% of those agreed that state aid for unemployed people is an essential characteristic of democracy, with an additional 35.1% skewing towards that poll and only 4.5% expressing strong disagreement. Some 22.1% agreed that income redistribution is an essential characteristic of democracy. Tunisia has again become a powder keg of economic and political grievances. These grievances are manifesting themselves in protests. Between 1st of January and 22nd of March 2018, data gathered by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Project shows that Tunisia witnessed 207 separate protests. This followed an especially contentious 2017, during which 678 different protests and riots were recorded across the country. In response to the current protests, Prime Minister Meshishi has reshuffled the cabinet and named 11 new ministers, four of whom are being investigated or suspected of corruption. Tunisians are craving for real change. Changing the figureheads will not work. As long as the rulers fail to realize this, the oppressed masses of Tunisia will continue to struggle for justice.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.